I'm Austin Lugo.
I'm Brendan Hess.
And this is the Nom Nom Project.
All right, so I think you had the first video after the last podcast, if I remember correctly.
So perhaps we should explain this to our audience before we actually get into it.
Oh, yeah.
All of our fellow listeners.
That would also be a good idea, you know.
So to all of our listeners out there, as you know, each and every day we release an Instagram and TikTok video, which is just a 1-minute exploration into some specific thing about Vietnam. Last week we covered a lot of the history of Vietnam, what Vietnam is like, the government, policies, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. So this week and the weeks following, we kind of want to get more into the individual questions we talked about during the week, because 1 minute, it's just not a lot of time. Often we have so much more information than we were ever able to talk about. I know you and me both, we often record videos that are well above a minute, 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, and there's just so much information that you have to cut out to get in that 1 minute time frame. So this is the place, this is the time to really just talk about the things we want to talk about. So today, the first thing I want to talk about is the exports of Vietnam. This is a video that came out exactly a week ago. We'll continue to kind of work our way up until we get to today's video, the one that released. Well, I guess not today for the listeners. That's a week ago. Basically, we're just going to do a weekend review. That's what we're doing. So, the first video was me, and the question was the exports and imports of Vietnam. Vietnam, although not well known for some reason, is the coffee capital of the world. It recently surpassed Colombia in coffee. I guess it's because of the humidity there or just the climate there, but they love to make their coffee there, so... You know, I'm very excited when we go to Vietnam. There's a city it's kind of like back in the 1930s and 40s. They'd have like these industrial complexes and they basically just like bought a whole city and like they owned everything. There's a company town that's just like it's a whole coffee town. Like everything is owned by this coffee company. It looks really cool and interesting. I can't remember the name of the coffee town at this time, but it looks fascinating and I'm really interested because even though I don't like coffee, I know you're a huge coffee fanatic. And
I do love coffee, all kinds.
I would like to like coffee, I just haven't gotten into it, so I think it'd be a good way to kind of explore the world of coffee in Vietnam. Vietnam's also a very large export in electronics. They're actually going to surpass China in the amount of electronics that they give to the U.S., even though the population's, what, 20% of China's? Significantly lower.
I think it's, what, the population is like 60 million people in Vietnam. I think that number is correct.
I believe it's currently 97 million in Vietnam.
For some reason, I switch 6 and 9 a lot. But China's like, what, over a billion? So the entire population of Vietnam is smaller than some of China's cities. So that is actually extremely surprising. I guess, in a way, it makes sense because China's slowly moving towards a policy of decreasing their exports with the United States. The plan for China was always to essentially use the United States as a springboard to like create a middle class and then eventually just start producing only for their own middle class. So I think there was always going to be a timeline where Vietnam ends up exporting more than China. But regardless, that's a lot of technology being given to the United States.
And a lot of that has to do with the fact that labor in Vietnam is cheaper than it is in China, and it's also more highly skilled in Vietnam than it is in China. So for those reasons, electronics are big there. Garments are also really big there. Actually, Vietnam provides more garments for the U.S. than any other country in the world. Of course, that includes like wool and I don't know what goes into garments. Cotton, things like that. They make the things that make the things.
When doing research into industrialization of the cities, finding that there's a significant amount of the labor force dedicated to sweatshop work. So in Vietnam, there's the ideal work, which I think is work in the state factories. And then if you can't get those jobs, you want to work in private firms. And if you can't get those jobs, like you're an unskilled laborer or you come from the farms and you don't have any education, then you get the jobs in the sweatshops. And those are like highly unregulated, but they make up like a significant portion of city economy. Vietnam exports a huge amount of garments, and that's where they make them, is in the sweatshops in the cities.
It's sort of surprising how few of their exports are based in farming practices, since 3/4 of the country is still farmland, and most people still live in the country. But unfortunately, farmers in Vietnam do not make a lot of money and often have to move to the city or have a second or third job. So the economy of farmland in Vietnam is a dying economy, which is unfortunate because for such a long time, that was kind of the backbone of the economy. But since the industrialization of the country, it's kind of fallen to the wayside. And even though, you know, a lot of the country is rice fields and that does support a lot of the country's food, it doesn't provide a lot economically. So a lot of people are moving from the countryside to cities, which, you know, makes one wonder what happens to all of those, you know, rice paddy fields and all that stuff.
I assume that Vietnam's always going to be a place that's making a lot of rice. That is sort of the thing that has allowed the region to sustain itself for, you know, thousands of years. But when you have an entire planet that's got industrialized farms, like the value of rice is just so low that, you know, even if you export all of your rice out of Vietnam, like you're just not making very much money doing that, which is why Vietnam had to, you know, resort to different kinds of labor, like, you know, making clothes and computers to actually have any chance of making a profit in trade.
All right. Well, that's all I have to say about the exports and imports of Vietnam. Brandon, the next question is for you. Tell me about the Vietnam War.
There's a lot to say about the Vietnam War. I think the TikTok video and the Instagram video were mainly centered around the outcome of the Vietnam War. And that mainly looked at like what the economic costs of it were. And I mentioned briefly that there was significant agricultural damage due to bombing and to chemical warfare. The United States did a lot of bombing of North Vietnam during the war. They focused mostly on targets in South Vietnam. So they were bombing North Vietnamese people who were invading the country. But they also did a lot of bombing of civilian targets. The ethic was that if we could destroy their infrastructure, not just their roads, but also their farms, then maybe we could like starve them into submission, like we're doing a siege. So as a result, we ended up bombing a lot of civilian towns and farmlands. No one really knows what the death toll is because there just weren't accurate records kept. Like most of these people were living in like pre-feudal conditions in like towns and villages where there was also no formal record keeping of that sort of thing. But it's probably somewhere in the hundreds of thousands, and some numbers put it up into the millions. There was a infamous incident where the city of Hanoi was bombed. That's the capital of North Vietnam at the time. That killed upwards of, like, I don't want to put bad numbers on it, but it was over 100,000 people that were killed in one bombing raid. And so as a result, when you drop a bomb on something, especially something that's really wet and marshy, the bomb doesn't always explode because there's not enough like impact force. As a result, Vietnam, especially the South, is littered in unexploded ordnances, which are there right now. They even have like a formal system where you can contact the government if you find an unexploded ordnance, and they'll like evacuate the town and like call in a bomb squad and like, you know, get a whole bunch of people out there to retrieve these bombs. There's also landmines too that were used by both sides, especially the North Vietnamese. But yeah, there's a lot of just explosives littered around the country of Vietnam. And there's occasionally stories of people just happening across these things or accidentally stepping on exploded landmines. And that's a major problem. There's also a lot more damage to villages than seems to be reported. I remember reading a story about a journalist who went to investigate a town that had, during the war, had undergone some sort of massacre. And while he was on the journey to go to the village to talk to people about it, he discovered not one, but like a dozen different monuments to massacres and to deaths and tragedies during the war. And so if you go out into the Vietnamese countryside, you'll just see tons and tons of different like monuments and tributes to bad stuff that happened during the war. I also mentioned chemical warfare. So not only did we drop bombs, but we also used something called Agent Orange. And we also used napalm. But Agent Orange was basically an attempt to salt the earth or to just destroy farmland, like an antibiotic chemical, which basically makes it impossible for anything to grow if it's present in the soil. And it doesn't really go away. So it will eventually dilute in the soil, which it's done now, but most of the Agent Orange that we've dropped is still like present in much of South Vietnam where we dropped it. And it doesn't just kill plants, obviously. It causes cancer, and I think it also causes like digestive problems. But essentially, if you have a lot of it in your system, it can like significantly lower your lifespan. So there's a major medical problems being dealt with now. And then there's also napalm, which fortunately, I suppose, once it burns, it's not there anymore. But it's unclear how many ecosystems and habitats we destroyed by burning out Vietnamese rainforests. But there almost certainly has to be a significant amount of damage. And the thing is, when you burn a rainforest, an ecosystem that wasn't meant to be burned, like rainforests very rarely encounter massive fires like we were doing to them. You can't recover those ecosystems. There's like fragile food chains that we almost certainly didn't know about at the time, but are not there anymore. And there's nothing you can really do about that at this point. That was the direct impact of the war, at least the United States' contribution to it. There's also a great deal of just casualties in general on both sides, because Vietnam was not an industrialized military. So their tactics relied on using bodies to cause casualties, which caused a lot of casualties on their side. I believe the military casualties are close to 1 million. That's from both North and South Vietnam fighting each other. There's also some good that came out of the war, because in order to oppose the United States, China realized that it might be a good idea to develop North Vietnam during the war. And as a result, they sent a lot of manpower into the area to build roads and bridges in Hanoi and along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So a lot of modern roads in Vietnam actually originated out of that system that was created during the Vietnam War. But otherwise, the whole thing generally wasn't very good for the Vietnamese people. After the war, there was a long period of embargo where the United States, being the sore losers that we are, were unwilling to trade with the communists. And since the Soviet Union was already beginning to collapse during that time, we're talking about like the mid to late 70s when this is all happening, there wasn't very many opportunities for Vietnam to trade. And because there weren't opportunities to trade, there weren't opportunities to rebuild. And so a lot of the damaged infrastructure and farmlands and beginnings of factories that they were starting to create during the war were unable to repair and develop. So not only was Vietnam essentially leveled during the war, there was also a period of 20-ish years. I think that's when they started liberalizing the economy to open up to world trade. But there was a period of like 20 years where it was essentially impossible for the country to develop. They were stuck in like post-war economic slump.
So I'm going to jump around a little bit here, because the next one I have is very lighthearted. So we'll push that one towards the end. And I want to talk about something related very much to the Vietnam War, which is the fall of Saigon, which of course happened on April 30th and marks the end of the Vietnam War, at least America's involvement in it. So on April 30th, America's like, oh shit, like, we're not going to win this war. So of course they did exactly what they did in Afghanistan just within the last year or two, which is they just go, okay, we fought this war that we were never going to win, and we probably shouldn't have been in the first place. So we're just going to immediately abandon, just take all of our troops like as quickly as possible, and just fuck off the people of Vietnam. And so America leaves. The southern Vietnamese people freak out because civil war, which they've just lost. Northern Vietnam invades. They take over southern Vietnam, and anyone who fought for southern Vietnam were sent to re-education camps, which were basically forced labor camps. The southern Vietnamese people did not want to go to forced labor camps because no one does. So famously, they would burn like everything they owned. They would burn uniforms, medals, anything that had anything to do with fighting for southern Vietnam. And those that still were terrified tried to escape. Unfortunately, being in a war-torn country and having lost the war, you don't exactly have a ton of money on your side. So a lot of people tried to escape via boats. These were called the boat people. Unfortunately, the countries that surrounded Vietnam didn't want the people. Most refugees, they were not wanted in most parts of the world. So over 25,000 Vietnamese people traveled by boat, and often boats that were not ever meant to travel as far as they did. And so they were traveling to these different countries, and while a couple of places did open refugee camps, most of them would send them back. It's very famous to, similar to when Jewish people were traveling to America to escape the Holocaust, they were sent back to Germany or sent away from the U.S. and eventually died on sea. This happened to over 50,000 Vietnamese people because countries refused to take them because they're refugees and they're going to take jobs away from us and all of that nonsense. And this goes on for 4 or 5 years before the UN finally steps in 1979. And they say, hey, like, you guys can't just keep saying no. Like, you gotta, these are human beings. We should accept them. So countries start accepting them. And even the US actually accepts hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese people. And the US actually now has the largest Vietnamese population outside of Vietnam, more than any other country in the world, which I didn't know about until very recently. And, you know, good for the U.S. They kind of describe the culture of how Americans felt when these refugees came. And the way they describe it is basically, so they came in two batches. In the first batch, the U.S. people, Americans, were very welcoming because they felt shitty about the whole murdering Vietnamese people for like 15 years. So they're like...
Yeah, being the sole reason there was a civil war in the country for so many years,
right? And creating the refugee crisis that existed. So they're like, oh yeah, come on, just come here, we'll be cool, you know, it'll be a good time. But unfortunately, by the time the second wave of refugees came, there was an economic slump in the United States. And of course, just like every economic slump in the United States, it was blamed on those that looked differently than the quote-unquote American. So Vietnamese people were highly blamed, and that led to a lot of crimes and violence upon the Vietnamese people, especially Vietnamese Americans and second generation or even third generation Vietnamese Americans, which is really unfortunate. But obviously, Vietnamese Americans, the thriving population here in the United States today. So although a tragic start, I guess it turned out well for them. I mean, you know, better now than 20 years ago, I guess.
And going back to what you said about the fall of Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City, which got its name directly after the Vietnamese occupied the city. Now, I don't want to sound like a communist apologist. Like, obviously, forced labor camps are very bad and all that. And, you know, there were definitely a lot of tyrannies carried out against South Vietnamese people and a lot of vengeance carried out against them by the soldiers. That undoubtedly happened. At the same time, my understanding of the war in Vietnam is that the South Vietnamese didn't actually want to fight a war for a very long time. The general opinion towards war with the North Vietnamese was, like, deeply unfavored among the South Vietnamese people. And it was only when the United States sent in military advisors and actual troops on the ground to garrison these places that the Vietnamese were attacking that they were actually able to recruit South Vietnamese to fight the North Vietnamese. It goes without saying that there were a lot of conscripts or people who didn't want to fight no matter what, but were forced to by the government of South Vietnam. It's important to remember that there actually was very little will for the Vietnamese people to fight each other during the war. It was mostly foreign powers that were coming in and causing the war to happen. And as a result, when the war was over, there was a lot less retribution actually than was expected. At least in the United States, the press or the propaganda mills were telling people that there was going to be genocides, there were going to be mass executions, that they were going to burn down Saigon and carry out all these like trials against people who were fighting the war. And some of that did happen. There was like stochastic violence against former soldiers and generals. But in general, South Vietnamese people were mostly left alone, except for the people who collaborated with the United States. And like you said, there were people put into re-education camps. So as long as you weren't capitalist, basically, you were fine. And that's not, you know, very great, obviously, because there were a lot of capitalists. But it's important to contextualize that with a lot of South Vietnamese people were mostly on board with the government once they...
And it's important to note that both Northern and Southern Vietnam, although technically Northern Vietnam was an atheist country at the time. They both had a very large percentage of people who were Buddhist and Taoist, which are famously pacifist religions. Unfortunately, they weren't really listened to, especially when foreign governments come in and decide that what you think doesn't matter because we want some sort of control, whether it's land, money, or what have you, or to stop the quote-unquote domino effect of communism, which of course was never the real concern of the United States, because they care about what they always care about, which is what every large capitalistic country cares about, which is money, the exploitation of people, just like they did in, you know, many other parts of the world. It just, because, you know, you look at many of the places that the United States quote-unquote freed or, you know, liberated, often the time those aren't considered wars because we won. It's only considered a war when we lost. So it's the Vietnam War because we didn't win. If we had won, it wouldn't have been the Vietnam War. We have just liberated the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, which, again, as you mentioned, really wasn't what anyone in North or South Vietnam really wanted. They were kind of coaxed into this war that hurt a lot of people and just not good.
But to end the discussion of the war on a high note, there was a massive celebration after the end of the war. Ho Chi Minh at that point had passed away. He passed away right after the Tet Offensive began. But I remember reading about parades that went on both in Hanoi and in Ho Chi Minh City at that point, which lasted for quite a long time. There was definitely a feeling of relief after the war had ended on both sides. And frankly, it surprises me how quickly the country stitched itself together. At least in the United States, the Reconstruction period took well over 100 years, I believe, and largely failed to amend the differences between the North and the South. But in Vietnam, they essentially created a new government. I believe they created a provisional government over the South for a while, but they eventually gave it more autonomy and control in the National Assembly. And that all happened within just a few years.
So way to go, Vietnam. You did it. So moving on, Brandon, the next question is for you. Can you talk a little bit about the educational system in Vietnam?
Vietnam is sort of unique among countries in that they tried very hard to create equitable by geography education system. So if you live in the countryside, the original idea or the philosophy behind it was that you would have access to as much education as you would in the city. This isn't as much the case in places like the United States, where if you live out in the farmlands in like rural Kentucky, chances are you're not going to be able to go to college unless you move into the city. But in Vietnam, they were trying very hard to make sure that there were public schools in every village, which is especially difficult in a country like that because it's very hard to build anything really outside of the city since you're in deep jungle out there. There's not very much road access either. This goal is slightly fallen to the wayside since it essentially became impossible to put as many universities out there and as many high-level education centers as was necessary. But in general, Vietnam is one of the best countries, if you're poor, to get educated in, at least relative to the rest of the people of Vietnam. Another thing is that I found it very interesting that you could get a degree in being a socialist in Vietnam. Obviously, since they're a communist country, they teach Marxist theory and the theory of materialism, theory of capital. And they teach that all the way in the first grade, I believe.
Start them young.
Absolutely. And so you can go through your entire education career just learning about materialism and how to apply Marxist theory to the real world. And if you make it all the way to college, you can get like a master's degree in Marxist practice, which is not very common for other countries. I can't think of a single other one. I don't even think you can do that in China. My understanding is that even the Chinese aren't very big on, well, the Chinese government isn't very big on Karl Marx or any of the original socialists, but they're still keeping it strong in Vietnam, at least in their education system.
So the next subject I wanted to touch upon is music, arts, and culture in Vietnam. I find the art scene in Vietnam to be incredibly interesting and fascinating. You know a lot more about the kind of physical art. I kind of looked more into the musical side of things, opera, that sort of thing. Opera's really big in Vietnam because when the French came during the Second Opium War in the 1860s, of course, the French love opera. So they're like, we're just going to build like a shit ton of opera houses. So in every major city in Vietnam, there's at least one opera house. And people love to go to the opera. It's like a big thing there. They have a specific type of opera that is particularly Vietnamese, which is kind of interesting. It mixes traditional opera with like rock music. So they often use like electric guitars and, you know, big like drum sets. And it's not as big as it used to be back in like the 70s and 80s when, of course, rock was really big. But it's still a very large part of the opera community in Vietnam, which is something. Dance is really big in Vietnam. They have dances that are particular to Vietnam. Of course, there's the dragon slash lion dance, which was originally from China. Often when you see images of the Chinese New Year, you see kind of like the like puppeteered dragons. They do something similar in Vietnam on, there's a name for Vietnamese New Year that I can't remember at the moment, but they do something similar to that with like a dragon and it moves around. It looks super fun. They also have what are called fan dances, which they use those kind of classical Chinese fans. And it's often five or six people in the group, typically women. And it's supposed to mimic the movements of a flower in the wind. It's really beautiful when you watch it because they kind of, instead of moving as individual dancers, instead of being like ballet where you have a dancer moving this way and dancer moving that way, they sort of move as one unit. And so the fans will often kind of move as one. It's absolutely beautiful if you ever get the chance to watch it. Similar to that is the hat dance, which is basically the same concept, except instead of using fans, you use traditional bamboo hats. And this is supposed to harken back to the farmers. And typically it's performed in kind of the countryside and small cities. And often the hat dances end by inviting audience members up and you're like supposed to dance with them and you bring a hat. It looks like a lot of fun. The final version of dancing that is specifically Vietnamese are called lantern dances, which is really cool. So they basically light lanterns. So there's like, you're holding like a little flame and it of course mimics the fan dance or the hat dance, but instead you're using lanterns. And then at the end of a performance, they actually release the lanterns and they like float away into the sky, which is pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I read very briefly about a kind of play they do in Vietnam where the stage is completely underwater. I don't know if you've read about this at all.
Oh, are you talking about water puppetry?
Yes, water puppetry. That's right. They use metal poles to raise puppets above the water. So all of the controllers of the puppets are under the water. And they do like these epic shows. And they typically depict like normal Vietnamese life. And characters travel through essentially the country of Vietnam over like a long period of time and go through these, you know, long journeys. I would really like to see what that's all about.
Yeah, water puppetry in Vietnam looks absolutely interesting. Puppetry is really big in Vietnam, probably because it was really big in China, so it was kind of brought over. Water puppetry began in the 11th century when the Delta would flood. Often they'd have these puppets and they're like, what do we do? And we're like in waist high water. So like, we're just going to make it look like these puppets are floating above the water. So you don't see any of the puppeteers. They're either hidden underwater or oftentimes they're hidden behind a bamboo wall and they have long metal poles that stretch out and they kind of move them around. It's really fascinating and interesting to kind of see them move. They're often like sketch shows or like it's a series of skits that are like 2 to 3 minutes and it's often like an hour long show. But it is often about the rural people, and they're supposed to be very humorous and fun and silly, and they look like a hell of a good time. I think if, you know, certainly if we have time, there's a famous theater in Hanoi and a famous theater in Ho Chi Minh, which are basically a classic theater, but in the middle of the theater, instead of a stage, it's a pool. So we should definitely check it out when we're there.
Absolutely. If only to see that theater. That sounds like a very unique theater. Yeah, so I also covered art, but I did more contemporary paint on canvas. I noticed that there seems to be a trend in Vietnamese art history where before the French, there was essentially just traditional tribal art, and that was in the form of ceramics and clay sculpture. But after the French came in, there was like a huge explosion of different styles of art. So I think they brought French Romantic painting, which is, you know, a very specific style where you put oil on canvas. But the Vietnamese also developed out of that different kinds of materials that they would paint on. And the most interesting one to me was silk painting. I didn't expect that you'd even be able to put paint on silk because of how like slippery and soft it is. But certainly they exist, and some of the paintings that they've made out of those silk canvases are beautiful. So hopefully we'll be able to find them somewhere. They have to be in a museum somewhere, right? There was a second major shift during the Vietnam War in history. And you mentioned that too, that there was a lot of like rock influence in their opera, and that came out of the United States being there and bringing all their Western rock influence. Similar things happened to Vietnamese art. Socialists really like to control the direction of art. I don't know if you've noticed this, but it happens everywhere. Wherever they take power, they like just completely change how art is made. So there was a shift away from French Romanticism and into, they call it socialist realism, but really it's just like realistic painting with muted colors and more accurate depictions of life without like all the glamour behind it. And that's kind of been the style of contemporary painted art since.
All right, last but not least, I wanted to end on a high note here. I wanted to talk about some of the most famous things to do in Vietnam as we prepare for our trip there. There's certainly a want and a need to kind of find the most exciting things to do. They span from the very city-like things, of course, the Ho Chi Minh City Museum, which is a history museum, which I think would be extra interesting because it is, of course, built by the communist government. So I'm interested to see their perspective on the American War, on Ho Chi Minh, perspective on really the last couple thousand years of Vietnam and how they see how it came to be. Because, of course, as you know, two Americans, we have a very specific view of Vietnam, even though we're trying to broaden our horizon. I'm sure it's very different than what the Vietnamese government believes. And of course, you know, they're also, just like every government, they have their certain propagandas of sorts, right? They're selling an idea, just like if you go to Smithsonian's, they sell a certain idea of what America is. So I'm sure Vietnam does the same thing. So Ho Chi Minh City Museum, History Museum, is something I'm very excited to see. Likewise, I mentioned the Fine Arts Museum in Ho Chi Minh City, which has a lot of the things that you talked about, you know, in French Romanticism and silk paintings and that sort of thing, which I think will be fascinating. Talking more about the countryside, of course, there are the paddy fields that date back all the way to the Han Dynasty and the BCE era. You can actually float down like a little river and you can take a boat tour and it'll take you past like miles and miles of just these beautiful paddy fields, and seeing all the rice, I'm sure, is as something that isn't here in the United States, I think is really interesting. I'm sure it's, you know, not that different from the cornfields or, you know, the wheat fields in America. And perhaps it's a little silly, but I think it's certainly something different than anything I've seen, since you can't grow rice here in the U.S.
I've heard that during the sunset, it looks especially beautiful because since it's all underwater and since the water is so like foggy because of all the food that's being farmed there, there's like a high degree of reflection of the sun. So during the sunset, like the whole landscape will like light up orange from the reflection of the sunset. So I'm really hoping that we'll get to see that and that we'll have a good perspective of that.
There's also the Golden Hands Bridge, and it's basically these two giant hands that hold up this bridge that you walk across. It's absolutely fascinating, beautiful. I mean, the hands are like the size of, they're like a size of a car. They're made of like stone and metal, and it looks cool. I mean, I don't think the bridge really goes anywhere, but it's a cool looking bridge.
A cool bridge is a cool bridge. I mean, we have some cool bridges in the United States, and they're always fun to drive across.
The last attraction that I wanted to talk about was the Phong Nha National Park. I specifically wanted to talk about this national park because it houses the world's largest cave. The cave is so large that you can actually fit an entire skyscraper inside of it.
That sounds amazing.
I'm excited. It looks cool.
Is that the cave that you hear in like viral news headlines occasionally about there being like clouds in it?
Yeah.
That sounds really fun. I'm very excited for that. Vietnam is littered with those kinds of geographic oddities. I think a significant portion of the country is like mountains, obviously. And because there's so much water, there's just tons of caves everywhere and interesting geography that you don't really see in the United States. I know that there's also the Ho Chi Minh Trail that you can still visit parts of, at least the parts that are in Vietnam, since most of it's actually in Laos and part of it's in Cambodia. I know that there's a park on the part of it that's near Hanoi. So hopefully we'll be able to go there because I know that you can actually go into some of the surviving like tunnel systems. Or you might not be able to go into them, but you can like see the network. Like they've built a park with like a big demonstration of how the tunnel system worked. I think that'd be very interesting.
Well, Brandon, any final things you want to say about Vietnam before we close out today?
Nothing that comes to mind.
All right, y'all. Thank you for listening. You can find me at AustinLuca12.
And you can find me at anything tagged Life Through Fictions as I work on all of it.
And you can find this podcast wherever you hear your podcast. You can also find us on Instagram and TikTok at The Nom Nom Project. You can also find everything we do here at Life Through Fiction Productions at lifethroughfiction.com. And please support our Patreon at patreon.com/lifethroughfiction. And thank you all for listening.